Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Group calls for an investigation of suspected atrocities in the Central African Republic, and South Africa delays a parole decision on an apartheid-era killer. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Amnesty International has published the names of people suspected to have committed human rights violations and war crimes in the Central African Republic. Jennifer Lazuda has details.
The new report, entitled Central African Republic, Time for Accountability, turns a spotlight on high-profile members of the mostly Christian anti-Balaka and mainly Muslim Seleka armed rebel groups, who are suspected of having committed serious crimes against humanity. The CAR has been plagued by religious and intercommunal violence since Seleka rebels overthrew the president in a March 2013 coup. It is estimated that thousands have been killed and more than 1 million people have been displaced. Amnesty International has documented some of the abuses and crimes since then, which include rape, dismemberment, mutilation, and large-scale civilian killings. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
South Africa has postponed a parole decision for the leader of a police killing and torture squad during the apartheid era. Eugene de Kock was dubbed Prime Evil for the crimes he and the clandestine C-10 unit committed against opponents of white minority rule in the 1980s and early 1990s. The country's justice minister says de Kock has made progress toward rehabilitation, but families of his victims must be consulted as part of the parole consideration process. De Kock was convicted of murder after his arrest in 1994 and sentenced to two life terms plus 212 years in prison. Now 65, he argues in his parole application that he is the only member of the C-10 serving time for the crimes the police squad committed. Israeli warplanes are relentlessly attacking the Gaza Strip targets in the third day of a campaign aimed at ending rocket attacks. Hamas militants are firing on Israeli cities. The Israeli military said its airstrikes hit another 320 Hamas targets today, focusing on underground tunnel networks and rocket launching sites. Palestinian officials say the three-day death toll had reached at least 76, including 8 in a building in Khan Yunus. 2 days of high-level diplomatic and economic talks between the U.S. and China have ended in Beijing, with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry praising collaboration between the countries. The sixth round of the U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue addressed issues ranging from climate change and cybersecurity to economic reforms and diplomatic tensions with China's neighbors. India's new government has unveiled what it says is a roadmap to revive economic growth, which has fallen to its lowest level in nearly two decades. Anjana Patricha reports.
Finance Minister Arun Jaitley says the government will leave no stone unturned to spur growth in a country, which he says is exasperated after growth has plummeted to less than 5% for two straight years. He was presenting the annual budget 6 weeks after the Bharatiya Janata Party came to power and promises of creating new opportunities for the 1 million people who entered the workforce every year.
The steps I will announce in this budget are only the beginning of a journey towards a sustained growth of 7 to 8%.
Promising to curb government spending, Jaitley said that he will contain the budget deficit to 4.1%. Anjana Basricha, New Delhi.
Germany has expelled the top U.S. intelligence official in Berlin, a highly unusual rebuke to one of its closest allies in the midst of allegations that Washington hired German operatives to sell its secret documents. A German government spokesman says the unnamed spy has been told to leave Germany. He said it was crucial for Germany to work closely on a basis of trust with Western partners. Germany is investigating the activities of two Germans who have allegedly spied for the United States, activities U.S. officials have declined to discuss publicly. In Washington, the White House said it had no comment on the expulsion of the intelligence official. A report in the New York Times today says the newspapers learned from U.S. government officials that Chinese computer hackers attempted to gain access to the personnel files of tens of thousands of federal employees who applied for top secret clearances. The report says the hackers gained access back in March to some of the databases of the Office of Personnel Management. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
It's not acceptable that people who have been involved in serious human rights violations continue living freely in Bangui and in other places, especially in Bangui where they are living just under the nose of the transitional authorities and the international community forces.
That's Amnesty International Central Africa Republic researcher Christian Mukosa. Details coming up.
Also in the news, on the third anniversary of South Sudan's independence, President Salva Kiir has appealed to rebel forces to return to the negotiating table.
We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Music from Uganda in our daily features, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Two ambassadors spoke today at a U.S. congressional hearing about efforts to combat the radical Muslim group Boko Haram. Ambassador Robert P. Jackson is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the U.S. State Department. He was joined by Nigeria's ambassador to the United States, His Excellency Abdulwale Adefuwe. Ambassador Jackson describes the U.S. government's efforts to support Nigeria in fighting the Islamic radicals.
Our counterterrorism assistance includes training on the detection of bombing, of bombs, basic forensics, border security, post-blast investigations, and crisis management. We're also providing assistance with negotiations and advice on how to conduct those negotiations, and this is an interagency team that's providing them. As for specific measures to prevent the movement of folks across the border, Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger have all sent additional troops to the border, with the Cameroonians having sent the largest foreign contingent to deal with this, and they have been engaging Boko Haram very successfully to date to keep cross-border incursions to a minimum.
Critics say Nigeria's military has killed or injured hundreds of civilians in the fight against Boko Haram. Congress supports a policy preventing U.S. government assistance to military units implicated in human rights violations. Ambassador Jackson says the policy has affected only a small percentage of the Nigerian military. He says 187 Nigerian military units and 173 police units have been approved to receive U.S. training and equipment. In 2012, the last year for which there are figures, the U.S. government approved 85% of Nigeria's security forces for training about 20,377 members. Jackson says that does not mean the 15% had committed gross human rights violations. He says it means that there were questions about their ability to receive assistance. He says the Obama administration has approved new language under the Counterterrorism Partnership Fund. That new language would allow the Defense Department to obligate funding that would be subject to congressional notification. He says these measures only affect assistance provided by the Department of Defense, not the State Department.
Nigeria's ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Adebowale Adefuye, expressed his frustration with critics of Nigeria's approach to battling Boko Haram.
When Boko Haram, you heard from Congress member the atrocity, just one instance, example of atrocity committed by Boko Haram. Nobody, those human rights group, they've never emphasized this, they've never publicized this. But when government now takes action on Boko Haram, they say, oh, no, you are violating his human rights. There's a proverb in Nigeria, I want to say, when the fly bites a man, there's no issue. But when the man bites the fly, people start talking. When Boko Haram kills people, just as the congressman member narrated, there's no issue. They are bad. And so we assume they are bad. Just leave them, don't commit. But when Nigerian forces have to use necessary force to stop Boko Haram, oh, you are violating human rights. There's been a debate, an argument between us and our friends in the State Department. And I think we are beginning to understand each other. That is just the nature of the problem dictates the nature of the response.
Ambassador Adefuye said the Nigerian government has purged officials suspected of cooperating with Boko Haram. He also said there are efforts on the national and local level to work with Muslim groups critical of the Boko Haram. He said Abuja is willing to dialogue with Boko Haram, but he says that's not an easy option. He says the group has been broken into many factions and has many shadow figures who don't express an ideology. Both ambassadors said they are combined efforts to ensure security in the north and to ensure that the region remains safe for citizens and investors.
And it's coming up on 11 minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Amnesty International has published the names of people suspected to have committed human rights violations and war crimes in the Central African Republic. The human rights group says these individuals must be investigated and held accountable in order for the country to begin a peace and reconciliation process. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The new report, entitled Central African Republic, Time for Accountability, turns a spotlight on high-profile members of the mostly Christian anti-Balaka and mainly Muslim Seleka armed rebel groups, who are suspected of having committed serious crimes against humanity. The CAR has been plagued by religious and intercommunal violence since Seleka rebels overthrew the president in a March 2013 coup. It is estimated that thousands have been killed and more than 1 million people have been displaced. Amnesty International has documented some of the abuses and crimes since then, which include rape, dismemberment, mutilation, and large-scale civilian killings. Amnesty International's CAR researcher, Kristen Mukosa, says most of the suspected perpetrators have enjoyed impunity, despite the fact that many of their crimes are known to authorities.
It's not acceptable that people who have been involved in serious human rights violations continue living freely in Bangui and in other places, especially in Bangui, where they are living just under the nose of the transitional authorities and the international community forces. This is unacceptable, and something must be done to ensure that investigations can start in those instances.
Some of the suspects, such as former President Francois Bozize and former Seleka leader Michel Djotodia, have been sanctioned by the United Nations and the United States for undermining the peace, stability, and security of CAR, but continue to move about freely. Others, such as anti-Balaka commander Richard Bajan and Colonel 12 Puissance, have spoken publicly about the crimes against humanity that they have committed and their role in inciting violence. Mukosa said that there are a number of reasons why suspected perpetrators have gone unpunished.
One of the reasons is that the judiciary is too weak in Central African Republic. The country has been in insecurity for a long, long time. There's also the issue of lack of independent institutions in the judiciary, but also the fact that since the beginning of this new crisis, most of the lawyers, judges, prosecutors are not around, actually, because some are now currently living in sites for displaced people, others have fled the country.
Kosa said those who are still around say they are afraid to start investigations due to fear of retaliation. Many of the courthouses and jails have been destroyed, making it difficult to even begin investigations.
This is why in this report we are calling for the authorities to seek assistance from the international community to ensure that investigations can take place and that no issues in terms of peace agreement, in terms of reconciliation, can long if there is no justice for the victims, if impunity continues for serious human rights violations.
On May 30th, CAR Interim President Catherine Samba-Panza formally requested the International Criminal Court open investigations in the country. The ICC has yet to accept or deny the request. Amnesty International is recommending a hybrid court be set up, in which international experts will help CAR nationals carry out investigations while strengthening the local judicial system. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
The Ethiopian government's news service confirmed yesterday that the Yemeni government arrested and turned over to Ethiopian authorities in Addis Ababa, an Ethiopian with British citizenship who was convicted in absentia 5 years ago on treason charges. Andargachew Tsegga, the secretary general of a political opposition group known as Ginbot 7, was picked up at the airport in Sana'a by Yemeni authorities on June 24th. He was flown to Ethiopia on the same day, according to Ethiopia's National Intelligence and Security Service. Amnesty International warns that Andargachew is now subject to torture by Ethiopia's authorities. Alan Hogarth of Amnesty's United Kingdom office says torture is a common practice among Ethiopian security forces holding political prisoners. Ginbot 7 was created in 2005 after a controversial city election that resulted in street demonstrations. The ruling party disqualified a municipal vote in which opposition candidate Birhanu Negga was elected mayor. Birhanu protested the government action by forming the opposition party Ginbot 7. Birhanu later declared that the party seeks democratic changes by any means necessary. The name of the party commemorates the March 15th date of the Ethiopian calendar of the aborted municipal election. Birhanu is now a professor of economics at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. The government accused the leaders of Ginbot 7 of attempting a coup in 2009 and pronounced the group a terrorist organization in 2011.
Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, this is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Heavy rains and flash floods have affected some 740,000 displaced people across Sudan. However, help has been on the way. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is conducting a campaign of life-saving services they refer to as WASH, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene. IOM is working in partnership with the World Health Organization and UNICEF. The campaign is helping to deliver basic water, sanitation, and hygiene campaigns to those areas hit hardest by the floods: Khartoum, West Darfur, and South Darfur. A major goal is to prevent disease outbreaks in areas where accumulated waste and garbage are posing health hazards, especially in urban areas. Dr. Aziza Elmaki is the emergency health specialist for IOM in Sudan. She explained the importance of the waste management campaigns there.
The WASH campaign had started on October and it continued for like 5 to 6 months. The WASH campaign was in response to the flash floods and the heavy rains experienced in 14 states across Sudan. The project was based on a rapid response fund through UN Central Emergency Reserve Fund, SERF, in partnership with UNICEF and WHO.
What exactly have you all been doing to promote personal and environmental hygiene and waste management?
Actually, it has been meant to provide basic water sanitation and hygiene life-saving services for people affected and displaced by the floods in the most vulnerable states across Sudan. This was primarily in Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan, West Darfur, and South Darfur. It was a rapid response that meant to reinforce and boost the most limited capacity of the partners to conduct preventive intervention of disease outbreak in the aftermath of these floods. So IOM role was basically the solid waste management activities, which had included the assessment of the areas, cleaning campaigns, and a variety of other relevant activities. We had the beneficiaries of more than 700,000. IOM worked with the Ministry of Health and the respective municipalities to identify these areas which had been in urgent need for waste management and waste collection activities. So we confirmed the urgency of this, and we had conducted the activities in one community, actually, through the whole 5 months. The campaign is comprised of over than 30,000 health promotion of house-to-house visit, distributing more than 18,000 information materials to those displaced persons, and there were like 2,000 hygiene kits that had been distributed in two camps, Kelma Camp and Suraif Camp, two of the most affected camps in South Darfur.
What type of training was conducted to promote hygiene?
100 persons from the two camps had been actually trained in how to conduct the hygiene promotion of minimum standards among their community of the internally displaced person. More than 70 waste collecting pins had been installed and we rehabilitated two tractors, one truck. We provide some equipment like garbage bags and wheelbarrows to the communities there to help them with the, like, daily activities that they do.
What has been the response of the displaced people who received materials and also the response of the training?
They were very pleased with this initiative, actually, especially women. We noticed that the women started actually cleaning in front of their shelter through the days of the campaign, helping us with our campaign. And most of those were very excited about the fact they are knowing more about their personal hygiene and the importance of cleanliness.
How long will this campaign go on?
It was a rapid response towards this activity, but with the background and of our head that we want to have those people responding to the community. It was 5 to 6 months because we, WHO and UNICEF, WHO and UNICEF, had been doing this at the same time. WHO and UNICEF supported the delivery of life-saving water services through certain strategies like operating, maintaining, rehabilitating the damaged water facilities and the damaged latrines for those displaced persons. So it was like, we can say, 6 months.
Going forward, do you think people will continue to practice hygiene on their own?
Yes, we think that they are fully now have the basic awareness of this. But finally, this was part of a holistic approach that we also prepare with a lot of partners and communities for the potential of this being like this, for the potential of upcoming heavy rains and flash floods that usually start within this month, actually, July and August. RM continues to participate in preparedness response with our partners to reduce the impact of floods. The last year is 2013, and this year also we are preparing for this kind of activity.
That was Dr. Aziza Almaki, the emergency health specialist for the International Organization for Migration. She spoke with me from Khartoum.
In Zimbabwe, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai of the MDCT is admitting that some missteps made in 2013 contributed to their shocking loss to the ruling ZANU-PF in the elections. The MDC leader also takes a swipe at the Zimbabwe Agenda for Sustainable Socio-Economic Transformation, or ZIMASET, saying it is doomed to fail. This comes as Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa is expected to lead a 20-member interministerial delegation to China, during which he hopes to convince Beijing to provide financial assistance for Harare's economic blueprint. Zimbabwe needs $27 million to fund ZIMASET. Tsvangirai tells reporter Blessing Zulu that ZIMASET is dead on arrival.
In my statement, I already said that ZIMASET without funding cannot be a panacea to our problems. There is no difference between ZIMASET, ZIMPRESS, all these other programs that have been announced and they've disappeared into the 13th file. For instance, I point out ZIMASET requires $27 billion. We are generating $4 billion worth of budget every year. So how do you get $27 million to fund this program?
What alternative policy do you have?
We do have a JUICE program, which is a jobs plan. The jobs plan is a very clear program that will entail reinvestment, increased production, and also employment creation. That's where the thrust should be.
You talked about correcting some policies. Are you talking here about indigenization?
Indigenization was something that was coined by ZANU-PF. We talked about empowering our people. The two are different. Indigenization, where it forces people to give up certain percentages of the value of companies, has destroyed confidence in the economy. Whereas if we had programs of empowerment, we would actually be creating platforms for our people to participate much more meaningfully. So the whole conceptualization of the indigenization policy, even ZANU-PF has admitted it needs to be reviewed. In the meantime, we have an economy where some of our own indigenous takeovers have actually failed because they've lacked financial backing, they've lacked training, they've lacked any partnership that is going to help the economy. So it's a disaster. Even ZANU-PF accepts that it has been a major failure.
Let's talk about the foreign policy. You also say Zimbabwe is a myopic foreign policy.
Well, first and foremost, our foreign policy should be that we will engage everyone on a win-win situation. What is the best interest of the country? We have a situation in which we have had a look-east policy at the expense of other countries that have been major trading partners for a very long time, created fissures that are totally unnecessary. So our foreign policy must be based on the best interest that we can derive from that relationship.
On the reflections, you seem also to be admitting that there were some things you overlooked on the elections. Is this your Damascus moment?
No. One needs to separate between the participation and the consequence of that participation. As I said in my statement, the rigging was far beyond even our understanding, even ZANU-PF's understanding. This was a highly militarized operation. If it had been the ordinary ZANU-PF shenanigans, we would have dealt with it. But this was beyond us.
Let's talk about the party Congress and how do you hope to emerge as a party in October?
The Congress is coming at a time when we have had this rebellion. It's coming at a time when there are certain narratives that are being promoted. It's coming at a time when the country is facing its biggest ever crisis. So we are focused. We want this Congress to be an issue-based Congress, not a position-oriented Congress. So this is going to be a Congress not based on just elections. Election is just but one of the last agenda items. But fundamentally, we are looking at the organization transformation.
Let's talk just briefly about properties said to be in the hands of the renewal team. How is it affecting the daily activities of your party?
Well, the party is of course, facing very serious financial situation. That's why we have put the burden on our members. We would rather not dwell so much on what property has been taken by whom. We have had this experience before in 2005, a much worse situation than we are facing now. So we will emerge because our people support us. And those who are committed to democratic struggle know that the so-called renewal agenda has nothing to do with fighting Mugabe or fighting ZANU-PF. So we will not put much attention to that. Whether they have one vehicle or one office, what does it matter to the struggle challenge that we face as a party?
From Harare, that was MDCT leader Morgan Tsvangirai speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu. This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir appeals to rebel forces to return to negotiations. And Amnesty International publishes the names of people suspected of committing human rights violations and war crimes in the Central African Republic. Coming up, we have music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, the government of South Sudan is renewing its commitment not to recruit more children into the National Army. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Buhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next.
Put your flags up in the sky. In the sky.
Juggle
and wave on Saturday.
Glad
to love.
You know that music means it's time for some World Cup news, and sitting in for Sonny Young today, we have the mighty Douglas Mpuga. What's on tap today, Douglas?
Well, Kim, we're kicking off with the World Cup in Brazil.
All righty.
Thank you. We are down to 2 matches left at the World Cup in Brazil. Argentine goalkeeper Sergio Romero saved 2 penalties in a shootout with Netherlands on Wednesday to take his country through to the World Cup final for the first time since 1990. Lionel Messi, Argentina beat the Dutch 4-2 in a penalty shootout after the semi-final in Sao Paulo finished goalless. They played Germany in Sunday's final in Rio de Janeiro. It was the second time that Holland, who lost the 2010 final to Spain, were beaten on penalties in a World Cup semi-final. They fell to Brazil in 1998. The result was a fourth win in 5 World Cup shootouts for Argentina, who will meet Germany in a repeat of the finals of 1986 and 1990. The Netherlands play Brazil on Saturday in the third playoff. However, Netherlands coach Louis van Gaal says having to complete a World Cup third place playoff match is unfair. The Dutch coach is not happy about this playoff, and he was quoted as saying, "This match should never be played. I've been saying that for 10 years. It's unfair." End of quote. Van Gaal, who is about to take over at Manchester United in UK, added, "There's only one award that counts, and that is becoming world champions." Nigeria has been suspended from all international football by FIFA amid allegations of government interference in its football federation. The ban means no Nigerian team, including club sides, can play internationally. FIFA had given Nigeria's government until Tuesday to reinstate the sacked Nigeria Football Federation NFF executive. The NFF was dissolved last week and replaced by a sole administrator. In a statement, FIFA, the world governing body, said the suspension will be lifted once the properly elected NFF Executive Committee, the Nigerian Football Federation General Assembly, and the Nigerian Football Federation Administration are able to work without any interference in the affairs. The most immediate effect is that Nigeria will not be entitled to participate in the upcoming Under-20 Women's World Cup, which starts on August 5th, should the suspension not be lifted by 15th July. VOA's Sunny Young sought out soccer guru David Legg for his reaction to Nigeria's FIFA suspension.
Yes, Sunny, this is a story we've had on The Voice of America so many times.
Voice of America!
Government stepping in, this time in the form of the Ministry of Sport, and basically sacking all the National Football Federation officials. And that's what Nigeria have done. They said this is as a result of their poor showing at the World Cup. I'm not so sure it was a poor showing. I think Nigeria achieved what I would call their minimum target, and that was to reach the second round. Of course, every Nigerian and every African, for that matter, wanted the Super Eagles to go further, much further, in fact. But they weren't in disgrace. They had their chances against France before losing that match. Now, FIFA, of course, take great exception to government interference. As far as they're concerned, a non-negotiable. Governments don't interfere. And every time we've had one of these clashes in Africa between the government, the National Association, and FIFA, FIFA always win. The most immediate effect will be that Nigeria will be prevented from starting the defense of their African Nations Cup. They're in the same group as, ironically, South Africa. Who knows? Keshi up against his old team. There's also Sudan. And then there's the winners of a preliminary tie between Rwanda and Congo-Brazzaville. If the Nigerians don't budge on this issue, Sonny, Nigeria will be disqualified from the Nations Cup qualifiers. And therefore, come Morocco next year, the Super Eagles will be nowhere to be seen.
David, Ivory Coast, like Algeria, now looking for a new national football coach. What's the latest?
Contrary to Giovanni Trapattoni, the 75-year-old Italian, Sonny, who told Italian radio that he had got the job, the Ivory Coast Football Federation, they beg to differ. What they are doing is they've set up a five-man committee, which will include Yeo Martial. He's the former coach of the national team, and he's the only coach that led Ivory Coast to Nations Cup glory back in Senegal in 1992. Also in his panel is a former captain of the national team, Cyril Domoraud, and they must come up with five names, the five people that they believe are best suited to replace Fabri Lamouchi, who really had to go. I think it was a bit of a calamity, really, that from a reasonable group, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't that difficult, Ivory Coast could not make the second round at the World Cup. A couple of other names that have been mentioned, Sonny, are Herve Renard and also Avram Grant. Now, Avram Grant may not be that well known to some of our listeners around the continent. He is Israeli by birth, and he's a former coach of Chelsea in the English Premier League. Certainly, Herve Renard would be an interesting choice. He did so well with Zambia, leading them to the Nations Cup in 2012. And also, Sonny, it would be ironic if he took over because he, of course, led the Zambian team to victory over the Ivory Coast in the 2012 final. Now, we've mentioned, Sonny, that Khalil Hodzik has gone, Lamouchi has gone, and, of course, Stephen Keshi has clarified his position. He says he didn't resign, that he was not offered a renewal of his contract. And following on from that, the South African Football Association issued a very stern denial of the fact that they had offered Keshi a two-year contract. The president of the South African Football Association, Dr. Danny Jordan, said there was not an iota of fruit in the rumor that Stephen Keshi had been offered a two-year contract. Keshi and the former Iran coach, Carlos Quiroz, a Portuguese, they are believed to be the favourites to succeed Gordon Eggeson in the South African hot seat.
That was soccer guru David Legg speaking to my colleague, Sunny Young. Now, the Confederation of African Football President Issa Hayatou has paid tribute to Somalia's first captain, Mohamed Khalaf Aden Shangole, who passed away on Tuesday. In a statement on the CAF website, Hayatou described Mohamed Shangole as an icon and legend of the Somalia game. Shangole was the country's first national team captain and went on to inspire many more players and Somalis with his contribution to the game behind his playing days. Shangole has been at Mogadishu Hospital for several days until he passed away on Tuesday. The first recorded national football team of Somalia in 1956 was captained by Shangole. In the same year, he led the team during the opening of the iconic Banadil Stadium in Mogadishu. Until his death, Shangole had been serving as the league advisor to the president of Somalia Football Federation. Now on to athletics. Double Olympic and world champion Mo Farah has pulled out of this weekend's Diamond League event in Glasgow because of illness. The 31-year-old was admitted to hospital in the USA with abdominal pain last week. Farah, who was due to race over 2 miles at Hampden Park, is having further tests in the UK this week, according to a statement issued earlier this week. However, he remains confident of being fit enough to compete at the Glasgow Commonwealth Games later this month. Farah confirmed in June he would compete for England in both the 5,000 metres and 10,000 metres at Glasgow 2014. Also, the Sainsbury Glasgow Grand Prix, the ninth of the 2014 IAAF Diamond League meetings, is set for Friday and Saturday this week. Among the stars will be Kenyan David Rudisha in the men's 800 meters. 2 years ago, on August 9, 2012, Rudisha produced what many regard as one of the greatest athletics feats of modern times, running solo to win the London 2012 Olympic Games gold in a barrier-breaking world record time. The memory of that extraordinary performance adds a certain air of anticipation to the 25-year-old's return to Britain this weekend. Temporarily switched from its traditional home in London while the Olympic Stadium is reconfigured to accommodate football, the two-day meeting at Hampden Park is the first ever Diamond League event to be held in Scotland and doubles as a rather high-class test event for the Commonwealth Games, whose athletics program will be held in the same 111-year-old venue, itself a football ground rejigged for the occasion. The former world junior, two-time African, world and current Olympic champion will be racing on Saturday for only the third time this summer following an injury-curtailed season in 2013 and is looking to build on his victory in New York a month ago.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
The IAAF World Junior Championships in Eugene, which will take place from 22nd to 27 July 2014, are on course to become one of the biggest gatherings in terms of participating IAAF member federations in the history of the championships. With the deadline of the final entries now closed, no fewer than 175 member federations have confirmed their participation in these championships. The most attended edition was Beijing 2006, where 176 countries gathered in the Chinese capital, followed by Annecy in 1998 with 170 countries. With a total of 1,406 athletes entered, that is 831 men and 715 women, the expected participation figure will be just shy of the record set at the last edition of the championships in Barcelona 2 years ago, making it the biggest ever age group athletics event held outside of Europe. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, the government of South Sudan is renewing its commitment to recruit more children into the National Army. Not to recruit more children into the National Army. And next, we focus on refugees in Uganda who benefit their host country rather than draining its resources. But first, some music. Here is George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Africa, I'm coming through my Nebadilika.
toko sala sala ko sala ki okudi.
Oh, Mama Africa, tunaomba upate baraka. Wale watoto wako, ndugu zote watakumbuka. Damu elimu hakika, na sisi tupate amani. Utaregesha takumbuka, tabariki tajirika, na sisi tuwache lia mama.
Okudi Music Dynasty, Washington DC, America. In the motion of the ocean.
Répète-toi la danse et la musique Eza de Jésus Christ au coup du Moana Kora.
Washington DC, hein?
George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Well, the government of South Sudan is renewing its commitment not to recruit more children into the National Army and to free those children already in its ranks. Defense Minister Kuol Manyeng Juk signed the agreement on behalf of the government at a ceremony in Juba yesterday. For VOA News, Mgumi Davis Rakawengi reports from Juba.
The UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zerugai, and head of the Children's Agency, UNICEF in South Sudan, Jonathan Viech, witnessed the signing of the government's commitment in which the Kiir administration vowed not to recruit children, to release the child soldiers it already has, and to prevent other violations against children. Juba first signed the action plan in 2009. The agreement, which was renewed in 2012, also provides for the SPLA to work with child rights organizations to reunify demobilized children with their families and to investigate other forms of violations committed against children. South Sudan's military spokesperson, Colonel Philip Aguer, acknowledges the SPLA has more than 200 child soldiers.
The number that is observed to be 249 will be immediately demobilized, and we will visit those locations together with the United Nations so that they are sure that the action is being implemented.
Aguirre says the SPLA has mobilized more than 7,000 child soldiers since 2007. Dun Porter, head of communication for UNICEF in South Sudan, says the recommitment will help protect children in a country where more than 10,000 people, including children, have been killed in the past 6 months.
These include killing and maiming of children, of course, it would be the most important one. Apart from the recruitment and use of children, sexual violence against children, attacks against schools or hospitals, denial of humanitarian access for children, and abduction of children.
Porter says a team of children protection officers will move around the country with SPLA officers to verify that there are no more children recruited into the army. Agueri says violations of the agreement will not be tolerated.
The army commander that will recruit child soldiers will be punished, and we will request civil societies and child organizations to help us in observing. Any observations reported to the SPLA will be verified and action will be taken. Already, the chief of staff have already issued a decree to punish anybody using child soldiers.
The UN says more than 9,000 children have been recruited into both sides, opposition and SPLA, since the conflict began in mid-December. And Porter says UNICEF has received assurances from the SPLM in opposition that it will abide by the agreement. For VOA News, I am Gumede Surakarinj in Juba.
A new report on refugees in Uganda finds that most refugees from other countries actually bring economic benefit to their host country rather than draining its resources. As Hilary Hewler reports, refugees in Kampala are supporting themselves without using humanitarian aid, and many are creating new businesses.
Kampala.
Charlotte Mapendo spends nearly every day walking the streets and dusty alleyways of her adopted home, Kampala. She carries folds of colorful Congolese chitenge cloth on her head, selling the fabric as she goes. Mapendo fled her native Democratic Republic of Congo 2 years ago after rebel soldiers killed her husband and knocked out her front teeth. She arrived in Kampala with nothing but the clothes on her back. She says she started her business by selling the chitenge she was wearing around her waist, using the little money she made to buy more. Right now, she only sells enough fabric to feed her 5 children, but she hopes eventually to scrape together the capital to open a small shop. A new report by the Refugee Studies Center at Britain's Oxford University found that refugees like Mapendo can have a positive economic impact on their host countries if given the chance to work. The report focuses on Uganda, where 99% of refugees earn their own incomes. The vast majority of urban refugees, it found, receive no international aid at all. Yusra Naguja of the Kampala-based Refugee Law Project explains that Uganda's policy requires urban refugees to support themselves.
They are self-sustaining. Yes, they might be staying in dingy areas and in the slums, but they are paying rent. So how are they able to pay this rent? Because no organization is paying rent for them.
This, she says, forces them to be industrious and resourceful. Many survive by selling cloth or jewelry or by braiding hair. Some manage to grow their businesses to the point where they employ other refugees, or even native Ugandans. She says the Somali refugee community in Kisenyi, a neighborhood in Kampala, is a good example of how successful they can be.
They're operating small businesses like selling perfume or selling beauty products or selling tea or food. And most of the petrol stations are operated by Somalis. They have big shops, they have butcheries. Basically, when you go to Kisenyi, business is for the Somalis.
Nor do they all focus on trade. Joshua Gatto is a Congolese refugee who's been living in Uganda for the past 18 years. He earned a university degree in Kampala and now works for an organization helping other refugees to adjust.
I work as a community interpreter. You know, refugees from eastern part of Congo and the Congo as a whole don't know English. I also help in teaching these refugees English language.
But despite the opportunities Uganda offers, Gatto says, he's still classed as a refugee and will always be considered a foreigner. He lives in fear that everything he's built for his family could be taken away.
The law does not allow me to buy land. The children don't see any future because I cannot plan. We are afraid that any time they can say, okay, refugees go back. And that's where the problem will come again, because I will not know where to go.
He hopes that someday Ugandans will recognize what refugees contribute to the country. Uganda should offer more than just a chance to work, he says. It should offer them a future. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tensions are high between Israelis and Palestinians in the wake of the vicious killing of three kidnapped Israeli teenagers, one of whom was an American citizen, and the brutal murder of a Palestinian teen who was kidnapped and killed after the bodies of the three Israeli teens were discovered. The three Israelis were missing for 2 weeks before their bodies were found buried under rocks in a field near the city of Hebron on June 30th. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the kidnapping. Right now, there are many indications pointing to Hamas's involvement, and it is also important to note that Hamas's leadership has publicly praised the kidnappings. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the murder of the Palestinian teenager on July 2nd a despicable act. He called for a speedy investigation to find the perpetrators and urged all sides not to take the law into their own hands. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry condemned in the strongest possible terms the murder of the three Israeli teenagers, Naftali Frankel, Gilad Shar, and Eyal Yifrak, and separately, the murder of the Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Hossein Abu Qadir. Calling the killing of the Israeli youths a terrorist act, Mr. Kerry said in a statement, "There are no words to express such horrific loss that shakes all people of conscience. We grieve with all the people of Israel." Knowing that Naftali was also an American citizen makes this an especially heavy blow, not just to Israel, but to the United States. The killing of innocent youths is an outrage beyond any understanding or rationale, and the perpetrators must be brought to justice. Secretary Kerry called the abduction and murder of Mohammed Hossein Abu Qadir despicable and senseless. Mr. Kerry said in a statement, "It is sickening to think of an innocent 17-year-old boy snatched off the streets and his life stolen from him and his family. There are no words to convey adequately our condolences to the Palestinian people." The world has too often learned the hard way that violence only leads to more violence, and at this tense and dangerous moment, Secretary Kerry said, all parties must do everything in their power to protect the innocent and act with reasonableness and restraint, not recrimination and retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.